Dutch have a cure for the loneliness of social distancing, a glass cabin for seniors and their families.
They need to see each other, they need to make eye contact, they need to laugh or cry together.
Trying to stay human during the pandemic. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, the Palestinian president has threatened it before, but now he might be serious.
The annexation is a new ball game altogether. This is a case of death.
And thanks to family Ramadan gatherings, a doctor treating COVID-19 patients in New York has something to look forward to at the end of each day.
I feel like I'm a normal person now. It's a huge change in my life.
And with summer approaching, when will you get on a plane again? Those stories and more today here on The World. Economies are starting to open up. Summer is just around the corner, and it's tempting to think, we got this. But what matters in a pandemic are numbers, and the numbers today remain pretty grim. 5 million. 5 million cases of COVID-19 globally. To get there, the world saw the highest one-day jump in cases ever this week. And the U.S. continues to be the epicenter of the pandemic. More than 93,000 of our neighbors have lost their lives. That's more than twice the number of deaths in the U.K., the country just below us on this tally sheet of catastrophe. And an almost unimaginable 20 times more deaths than in China. This thing is far from over, even as countries start to cautiously reopen. That is the big picture. Now let's zoom in on one of the storylines playing out behind these numbers. The U.S. has continued to deport people throughout the pandemic.
This is something we've used in years past, and it's something that we need to have in place to mitigate this pandemic.
That's Border Patrol spokesman Justin Castrojón speaking with the CBS affiliate in San Diego. Overall, the U.S. has deported more than 20,000 people to several countries since the coronavirus pandemic began, including to Guatemala. Health officials there say dozens of deportees arriving from the U.S. are testing positive for the coronavirus. And as the world's Jorge Valencia reports, that's creating some serious problems.
In Guatemala's second biggest city, government officials have been housing newly arrived deportees in a sports complex, and the neighbors are none too happy about it.
If
just one person gets infected, our whole neighborhood will get shut down, a man tells a local journalist in this video. The man is wearing a blue face mask, and he's surrounded by a crowd of neighbors gathered outside of the sports complex. Police officers in riot gear guard the entrance. We want the migrants out of here, the man says. We've been working too hard to take care of our families for the government to bring the coronavirus to our doorstep. No, sir, the man tells the reporter. We will take matters into our own hands. People across Guatemala are under a curfew and mostly staying at home. Many are blaming the country's growing number of coronavirus cases on deportees from the U.S. and Mexico. Guatemalan officials say more than 100 people sent back from the U.S. have tested positive for the coronavirus.
We're
very worried here in Guatemala, especially here in this city, says Juan Fernando López. He's the mayor of Quetzaltenango. That's where the people were protesting outside of the sports complex. López says he understands that migrants contribute to Guatemala's economy. Remittances added up to 12% of GDP last year. I know what it's like to get picked up by U.S. immigration agents, López says. He himself migrated to Pomona, California, and worked as a mechanic for 5 years in the 90s, sending money back to his family. But he says deportees being sent to Quetzaltenango right now are putting people at risk.
Que cada gobernador de su departamento pueda hacerse cargo de sus propios migrantes de su departamento.
We want the Guatemalan government to send the migrants back to the communities where they came from, López says. Guatemala's national government has repeatedly asked the Trump administration to pause deportations altogether. Human rights advocates have called for the same thing. One advocacy group, Asociación Popnoj in Guatemala City, is running public service announcements on radio stations, reminding people that migrants have rights.
Las hermanas y los hermanos migrantes que regresan tienen derecho de volver a sus comunidades.
Our brothers and sisters have a right to go back to their communities, says this one radio ad. Let's help them reintegrate with dignity. In the Quetzaltenango region, the ads are in one of the indigenous languages, Mam, and they're directed at deportees. You're returning, this ad says. Protect yourself and your family from the coronavirus by going into isolation. Elda Bautista is from a small village, and she had been trying to reach her husband, who lives in the U.S. That was before she was detained for months and was deported in mid-March. Bautista says no one examined her before she was sent back from a detention facility in Texas. She says when she landed in Guatemala City, someone took her temperature and asked her if she was feeling okay. She says thank God she hasn't been sick and that she's been moving around freely in her community. Deportees in other parts of Guatemala have been less fortunate. They've been turned away when they arrive to their hometowns. Bautista admits that she worries about migrants being deported from the U.S. and bringing the coronavirus to Guatemala. She says everyone around her is healthy, they don't want to get infected, and maybe it's good to keep people out. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
In China, there's a new coronavirus lockdown in the northwestern provinces. Officials are slowly reopening other parts of the country while trying to avoid new outbreaks. But farther south in Beijing, an official announcement that has nothing to do with the coronavirus is rattling the world today. That's a spokesperson for China's National People's Congress, Zhang Yesui, today. He's announcing a new proposed law that would give the Communist Party full control over Hong Kong. It would end the one country, two systems framework that has given Hong Kong autonomy from mainland China for more than two decades. Wilson Leung is an attorney in Hong Kong and a member of the Progressive Lawyers Group. He says Beijing does not have the legal authority to enact national security laws on behalf of Hong Kong's government.
Beijing is proposing to do it directly for Hong Kong, thereby bypassing the city's own legislature, which in fact is already dominated by pro-Beijing parties. But Beijing is proposing to take it even further and directly draft a document to be applied in Hong Kong.
Article 23, as I understand it, of Hong Kong's mini-constitution, it's known as the Basic Law, says a city must enact national security laws to prohibit, quote, treason, secession, sedition, and subversion against the Chinese government. So legally, can't China do this?
In fact, it's fairly clear that Hong Kong is supposed to do it on its own. So it's actually very clear from the words of Article 23 itself. And it's also clear from another article, Article 18, that Beijing is only supposed to do direct legislation in very specific categories, namely things relating to defense, foreign affairs, and other matters not within the autonomy of Hong Kong. So it was specifically written in the Basic Law that Beijing is not supposed to directly legislate for Hong Kong for most matters. And specifically for national security, it's supposed to be done by Hong Kong on its own. And this was a very important protection that was built in. It was a promise that on this, you know, very important and potentially controversial matter, at least it would be Hong Kong people writing the laws for itself. When we've seen Beijing now just completely wipe that aside.
So here's what Hong Kong lawmaker Dennis Kwok, he's a founding member of the Civic Party. Here's what he makes of this move by China's government.
I just want to say to the international community that this is the end of Hong Kong. This is the end of one country, two system. Make no mistake about it, that Beijing, the Central People's Government, has completely breached its promise to the Hong Kong people, a promise that was enshrined in the Sino-British Joint Declaration and the Basic Law. And they are now completely walking back on their obligation owed to the Hong Kong people. This is it. Make no mistake about it.
Wilson Leung, does that sound like a fair assessment?
It's a strong assessment and also a fair one.
So if this security law goes through, what would it mean in practical terms for the citizens of Hong Kong, just in their everyday lives?
Well, of course, the details are still to be announced, but it's a fair guess to say that it'll be quite a heavy restriction on the freedom of expression and the freedom to demonstrate and to protest in this city. Because we've seen how in mainland China itself, very broad terms such as national security or terrorism or secession or even picking quarrels are used to suppress dissent and to crush the opposition. So there's a real risk and a real danger that similar moves are going to be used in Hong Kong to effectively suppress all signs of the protests and dissent to Beijing.
Wilson, why do you think Beijing is introducing the security law now?
I think it has this idea that the world is distracted by COVID-19. And so we've seen a number of things it's been doing, not just in Hong Kong, but around the world. So we've seen moves in the Taiwan Straits. We've seen moves in the South China Sea. And we've also seen actually other tough moves in Hong Kong itself in the past few weeks. For example, on another issue, they proclaim for the first time that they have the right to intervene in Hong Kong's affairs, which seems to be in breach of another article in the Basic Law. But they've been asserting that right. And now we've seen yet another blow. And I think they're calculating that the world won't do anything because it's distracted and relies on China for various protective equipment.
So China has tried to do something like this before and failed precisely because of the wave of opposition on the ground there in Hong Kong. But now, given the clampdown on movement due to the coronavirus, won't the opposition have a very difficult time mobilizing?
I think that's a correct concern. We've seen that the social distancing restrictions have been extended to June 4th, coincidentally the night of the annual Tiananmen vigil. So that's been held off. And we've seen in the last few weeks how the police have cracked down quite violently and also selectively against any attempts to protest. So we've seen quite disturbing scenes on the ground. We've seen hundreds of people arrested. We've seen riot police press 10-year-old children to the ground and so on.
So, Wilson, what do you see coming in the months ahead?
I see very tough times for Hong Kong indeed. We've seen that Beijing is now shaking off any traces of restraint. And in fact, we saw that they backed down from a similar law in 2003 after protests. Even in 2015, when they enacted their own national security law, we saw that they pulled back from directly legislating for Hong Kong on the same law. But we've seen that they've now removed any restraint. They're sharpening their knives and seem to be intent on crushing the opposition once and for all, and by hook or by crook.
Wilson Leung is a Hong Kong-based lawyer and a member of the Progressive Lawyers Group. Thanks for being with us. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
The National People's Congress says asserting control over Hong Kong will improve its governance and ensure long-term stability for the territory. China's foreign ministry sent a letter to ambassadors in Beijing urging them to support the move. The Congress will hold its annual session starting tomorrow. The law could pass as early as next week. Coming up, charter jets with curtained windows, bullet trains and luxury hotels, and now two arrests. New details emerge in a caper surrounding a former titan of international business. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Almost no industry has been as hard hit by this pandemic as airlines. Globally, we're taking only about a quarter of the flights we used to. Greenhouse gas emissions from flying are expected to be down nearly 40% this year. How quickly we get on planes again and how different the industry looks once we do, that'll have big implications on climate change. That's what we're talking about in this week's Climate Solutions segment, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The world's environment producer, Anna Kussmer, is with me to discuss the future of flying. So in the short term, Anna, it seems like the biggest question surrounding airline emissions is when we'll start flying again. So when does flying start to look like it used to?
That's partly up to us, Marco, and when we feel safe getting on planes again. The consumer psyche is really hard to predict, as you can imagine, and it's hard to know how quickly the industry will rebound because of that. We asked you, our listeners, what you thought about getting on a plane, and we got a lot of this kind of answer.
The planes, with its various germ-gathering possibilities, probably my least preferred method of travel, aside from a cruise ship.
That was Attila Gapadok, who listens to us on WVTS in Roanoke, Virginia. He told us he's going to look into train travel instead. Besides the safety and health stuff, another question is whether things that we used to fly to will happen more often virtually since we're all on Zoom these days. Will Jasper in Washington State told us he expects that to happen to him.
Work-related travel is likely to reduce with the wider acceptance of video conferencing tools for meetings and conferences, things like that.
There are so many variables that will impact how much we fly around, and airlines are trying to kind of game out all those different scenarios.
We have heard that some airlines are leaving middle seats empty for social distancing. I've also heard that Australian airline Qantas threatening that fares would jump ninefold if they had to observe social distancing. That kind of price hike would seriously impact demand, I'm guessing.
Right. So these are all questions about how the shocks of the pandemic will impact demand. In the short term, it's all about when people decide to get back on planes. But in the long term, airlines are going to need government bailouts to survive. And the question is, how can these bailouts be used to push for more sustainability in the industry?
Yes. So that kind of scheme, tying bailout money to emissions reduction, is that an idea that's getting traction anywhere?
Yes, especially in France. Here's Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire announcing a $7.5 billion package to bail out Air France.
Je veux redire que ce soutien à Air France n'est pas un chèque en blanc.
He says it's not a blank check. It has conditions. The airline must reduce its emissions by around half by 2030 and develop alternative sources of fuel for its planes. Also, we heard UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson talking about how he wants to look at how to keep emissions down as well.
I don't want us going back to an era of the same type of emissions as we've had in the past.
The Austrian government minister said state aid for the airlines should support cutting their emissions as well. So it's a bit of a trend, particularly in Europe, that we're hearing more leaders talking about this.
Yeah, what's the reaction been from the industry?
The CEO of Airbus is asking the French government to use stimulus money to support their efforts to develop more environmentally friendly planes. However, more broadly, airlines are lobbying governments to put a hold on carbon taxes that they normally have to pay because the industry is suffering so much.
I mean, it seems all well and good to set ambitious targets, but if airlines are taking such a financial hit right now, how are they supposed to meet those targets?
Yeah, it's a good question. There's been this sort of race to the bottom in the airlines industry, cutting costs and amenities, and essentially squishing as many people into the planes as possible. Susanna Beckin is a professor of sustainable tourism at Griffith University in Australia, and she says this trend has come at the cost of sustainability efforts as well as comfort.
You could argue the aviation market is highly inflated. There's probably too much seat capacity that can only be filled by making tickets really cheap, and that doesn't leave any margin for innovation and future-proofing. Now in the crisis, it is revealed it's just not sustainable.
So Beckin says because airlines may not be able to pack their flights and grow at the same rate that former business model requires, the pandemic could end this sort of race to the bottom that we've been seeing. And the bailout money could be used to encourage airlines to retire older, less efficient planes. Dan Rutherford, the aviation director at the International Council on Green Transportation in San Jose, California, says the bailout money could kickstart big, ambitious innovation for more efficient engines and planes.
An Apollo-style research and development program to develop advanced aircraft engines and low-carbon fuels that we'll need over the long run.
So basically, it's time for thinking outside of the big metal box. There's definitely more bailouts coming from governments, and we'll see soon what they look like and whether or not sustainability is part of them.
Anna Kussmer, environment producer for The World. Thank you.
You bet.
The story of former Nissan CEO Carlos Ghosn just gets weirder and weirder. And now the people who helped him escape to freedom have been arrested themselves. Carlos Ghosn's wild saga began a year and a half ago. Here's CNN at the start.
Breaking news. In the past few minutes, Nissan has revealed that its chairman has been arrested. Nissan accuses Carlos Ghosn of underreporting his compensation and the personal use of company assets.
Tokyo authorities detained Ghosn, 108 days later,
former Nissan CEO Carlos Ghosn is now out of jail after posting bail.
While out on bail, Ghosn was introduced to a man from just outside Boston, Michael Taylor, former Green Beret, now a security consultant, and his son, 27-year-old Peter Taylor. They helped Ghosn escape from Tokyo, and then they went on the lam.
Public records show they live at this house in Harvard, where a no trespassing sign hangs at the end of the driveway.
Boston local news on the case back in January. The Taylors were arrested yesterday in Massachusetts. In court, details of their story emerged. The younger Taylor met the former Nissan CEO at a Tokyo hotel last December. They took the bullet train to Osaka, where Father Michael Taylor and another associate were waiting, posing as musicians. The Taylors packed Carlos Ghosn into a large black box. They told Japanese customs agents it was recording equipment. Then Ghosn was flown in a chartered jet to Istanbul. Then he switched planes to Beirut. Lebanon has no extradition agreement with Japan, and Ghosn remains in Lebanon today. The original reports were often fantastically incorrect. He hid in a cello case. The instrument itself belonged to a group of Gregorian musicians. The scheme was colorful, just not that colorful. Carlos Ghosn, however, is.
What's your secret vice?
I'm a gourmand. A gourmand is somebody who cannot resist a good food.
This is from a video with Ghosn from 3 years ago.
You're French and Lebanese and Brazilian. What is home for you?
Well, it's not a country. Our different cities. I'm more a network of Rio de Janeiro, Beirut, Paris, and Tokyo.
The moral of the story? If you can afford a charter jet, you can apparently get really big boxes on board a plane with few questions asked. All right, with many of you working from home, you might be relying more on smart speakers. The World has a show made specifically for smart speakers. It's called The Number in the News. Catch it every morning for what you'll find to be some surprising news stories and add it to your flash briefing in the Alexa or Google Home app on your phone. Find out more at theworld.org/smartspeaker. You're with The World. In Madrid, a self-styled Don Quixote takes on the establishment in this time of quarantine.
Like the protagonist of Miguel de Cervantes' classic novel, he's undertaking noble deeds to save Spain from itself.
His lockdown campaign? Let the people use the public parks. I'm Marco Werman. That story's still ahead here on The World. In Canada, the new coronavirus emerged when the western province of British Columbia was already battling a different health crisis, skyrocketing deaths from drug overdoses. Concerns grew that these double emergencies could fuel an even bigger problem, and so the government decided to try something pretty controversial. The World's Alana Gordon has that story.
Henry Fester is 61 years old. He's used drugs for a very long time.
I was a functioning addict most of my life. I have several children. I worked in the entertainment industry.
Fester lives in Vancouver's downtown east side. He says what drives him to do whatever it takes to find heroin is not so much to get high. It's to avoid the chills, the shakes, the fevers, and pains.
That's basically all I'm doing is fighting off withdrawal.
But that constant drive looming over Fester dissipated recently. His stash now comes straight from the drugstore, and no, he did not rob it. Fester's got a legit prescription for heroin, or rather, a pharmaceutical equivalent.
Right now, I'm being prescribed 16 Dilaudid 8 pills in the form of pill form, 16 a day.
He only has to go to the pharmacy once a week to pick up his supply. He takes the pills home, crushes them, and injects them. It is quite the transition from the constant desperate hunt for the next hit.
I'm so lucky to have what I have.
Fester's new normal is in large part because of the pandemic. In March, British Columbia issued new guidelines for supporting people with drug addictions during a lockdown. Among other things, the guidelines make it easier for doctors to prescribe controlled substances like opioids and stimulants off-label as replacements for people who would otherwise seek out similar drugs on the street. Judy Darcy is British Columbia's Minister of Mental Health and Addictions.
So we knew we had to act quickly in the context of a dual public health emergency in order to keep individuals who are struggling with addiction safe and to keep the community safe from COVID-19.
Darcy says the province has been in emergency mode for years, in part because of a tainted, illicit drug supply. It's one that's been laced with a highly potent synthetic opioid called fentanyl, and it's led to a surge in overdose deaths. The province expanded treatment programs and injection sites where people can use drugs under supervision. But Darcy and others worry that COVID-19 is making the situation worse. The pandemic and all the border closures have interrupted global supply chains, including that of the illegal drug trade. Major ingredients for fentanyl come from China, and more specifically, Wuhan. And so dealers have been filling that gap with who knows what.
Things have never been worse as far as the toxicity of the drugs and them being adulterated with even more dangerous substances than before.
Darcy and others sounded the alarm in March when overdose deaths went up in British Columbia to more than 100, the highest monthly toll in over a year. Cheyenne Johnson is with the BC Center on Substance Use, the agency that put together these new guidelines. She says creating a, quote, safe supply of drugs makes sense right now, but it's not meant for everyone and requires a nuanced approach.
It really is individualized based on the individual person's medical history, what substances they use, how they use them. You know, have they had an overdose in the past? Have they tried treatment?
Even before the pandemic, the Canadian government had supported several programs for prescription heroin. But the new, broader approach, which includes prescriptions for other drugs like Ritalin and benzodiazepine and less supervision, is really uncharted territory. Even doctors on the front lines of the crisis, who've been leading the push for a safe drug supply well before coronavirus, have some concerns about how all this is done. Dr. Mark Tindall is a professor at the University of British Columbia. He's prescribing drug replacements to people, but very carefully.
It's really operationally very difficult to give people, you know, a large supply of drugs and tell them to go sit in a room and use them over 2 or 3 weeks. I mean, it's like giving somebody with a gambling problem, you know, $1 million and telling them to save their money. I mean, it's not fair to the people getting the drugs even.
Right now, several hundred patients are getting scripts under the new guidelines. For Henry Fester, who's one of them, he says now that he's not consumed each and every moment of his day with how he'll get drugs, his life has totally changed. He's reconnected with family and a teenage granddaughter.
I started to get my life back to the point that this is what it used to be like before I lost control, you know. It's given me time to reflect on what life is all about as well.
This moment marks a new freedom for Fester, even though he's mainly confined to his home because of the current COVID restrictions. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Tensions are on the rise in the Middle East. Israeli plans for annexing parts of the West Bank are moving forward with the blessing of the Trump administration. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is pushing back. That's Abbas in a speech earlier this week. He announced that the Palestinian Authority would no longer cooperate with Israel and the U.S. on security issues. Ambassador Hussam Zomlot is the head of the Palestinian mission to the United Kingdom. Palestinian officials' ambassador referred to this as a Judgment Day scenario because of its potential to cause chaos and violence. The security cooperation with Israel has also benefited the Palestinians, so why go down this route?
Because since Netanyahu was elected Prime Minister of Israel in 1996, the two-state solution and the peace process has been on a deathbed. What annexation would do, as declared by Netanyahu himself, would be switching off the life support machine, which is primarily that we could change the de facto control of Israel, the status of military occupation, roll it back, end it via a process, via international mediation, but changing that from a de facto illegal control to what Israel would describe as a de jure annexation would be a game changer. And therefore, we are not in the business of just wasting time, and we will have to look into alternatives to achieve our legitimate rights.
It does take two to tango, though, and remaining in the peace process means you're actually keeping it alive to a certain degree. Are you worried that the other players are now going to say the Palestinians were not as serious as everybody thought they were?
The international community knows this very well, that the Palestinians have really been engaged for more than 27 years. However, the annexation is a new ball game altogether. This is a kiss of death to any prospect of a genuine, sovereign, independent state of Palestine.
In his speech, President Abbas did not set out a timetable for withdrawing from the agreements, and he did not explain how the Palestinian Authority would function without the agreements that really support its existence. Have you been updated on any specific timeline for this?
Well, this isn't about timeline. President Abbas, the Palestinian leadership, and the Palestinian people have arrived at a moment of truth. So far as a political process with Israel, this will not deliver a two-state solution as espoused by the international community. And I'd like to remind our listeners here that the two-state solution was never a Palestinian demand. It was a Palestinian concession. It is, first and foremost, an international formula. Unfortunately, throughout this process, Netanyahu has been capable to actually derail. The U.S. has done little over the years to curb Netanyahu and the Israeli right. And now the U.S. administration, that is the Trump administration, is directly complicit and directly involved in the annexation and the illegality. And the rest of the world is incapable to do any substantial consequences for Israel actions.
Ambassador, how concerned are you that as the decades-long goal of a two-state solution seems to be evaporating before our eyes, that young Palestinians, beset by conflict fatigue, will be almost relieved that as long as they have rights in an Israeli state, they'll be more or less satisfied?
I'm not concerned. And if the people of Palestine decide to go for one state, equal rights, let it be. It's a decision for the future generations. But the previous generation have tried in the most genuine possible way to achieve a solution based on international legitimacy. We have failed. If the next generation decide that the best course of action is equal rights, let it be. And, you know, I believe that the world will support Palestinian quest for such equal rights. I mean, I don't believe anybody in the U.S. or anywhere else would question the very legitimate demand for, you know, all men and women are equal. This doesn't mean the end of the Palestinian cause. No, it only means the beginning of a new journey.
Ambassador Hussam Zomlot is the head of the Palestinian mission to the United Kingdom. He's been speaking with us from London. Thank you for your time, Ambassador.
You're most welcome, Marco.
This Saturday marks the end of Ramadan. It's the month-long observance that Muslims around the world mark with prayer, charity, and fasting. Many people used to breaking the fast after sundown with large family gatherings find the holiday a much quieter event during the pandemic. But for one Syrian-born doctor in New York, this Ramadan actually got a lot less lonely after years of celebrating it without his family. Reporter Ari Daniel with our WGBH partner program Nova has our story.
Rami grew up in Syria in the 80s, in the city of Homs. As a boy, he remembers Ramadan was a centerpiece of life.
When you go out, you see like no cars in the streets, all the stores are closed, all the people are with families. So we gather as a family, my father, my brother, my sisters. We eat, watch TV a little bit, then go to the mosque.
But to become a doctor, Rami had to leave his family behind in Homs. First for medical school in Damascus, and then for his OBGYN residency in Aleppo. He was a natural. Some families even named the babies he delivered after him. But supply shortages made the work difficult.
We're missing medication, missing equipment, so we always try to find alterations. I remember multiple times when I have to do a C-section on the cell phone flash.
You mean the light from the cell phone?
Yeah, from a cell phone.
A lack of machines like incubators meant babies sometimes died needlessly. Rami returned to Homs after his residency and fell in love with his future wife, Shaza.
He was very funny and I liked his honesty and determination to be like a doctor.
Rami was finally back home with family. But by this time, in 2012, Syria was slipping into civil war. Rami said the government of Bashar al-Assad didn't permit his patients to go to the hospital, so they had to sneak out to have their babies delivered. Practicing medicine in Syria became increasingly difficult. A month after celebrating Ramadan at home with his family that year, Rami, who asked me not to use his last name to protect his family in Syria, once again relocated.
When you finish your studying, you have to go to the army. So I didn't want to serve that army, so I moved to Jordan.
On his own. He continued to treat many Syrian refugees in Jordan. The days were long. During Ramadan, it seemed to him that women timed their births to coincide with the day's break fast.
I mean, I know my luck. I'm not the lucky person.
He'd drink water, deliver the baby, and then, an hour late, break his fast in the on-call room of the hospital with other doctors and nurses. They'd eat simple things like chicken and rice. Rami and Shaza married but lived apart. And still, practicing medicine was filled with obstacles. The field hospital where he worked in Jordan lacked resources, so C-sections and blood transfusions were out of the question. In late 2013, Rami got a visa to come to the U.S., to New York.
When I came to the United States, I applied to increase my experience. I want to be a doctor here. I want to be exposed to the new fields.
Rami eventually landed a job as a resident at Brookdale Hospital Medical Center in Brooklyn. But his wife's visa application kept getting denied, so they continued to live apart. They'd keep Skype on for hours.
We talk, we eat, we study, sometimes we sleep.
You would sleep with Skype open?
Yes, sometimes.
For seven Ramadans in a row in the U.S., Rami was on his own, far from home.
The most challenging thing was eating alone, because this is the time when the family gather and eat together, having fun. But for me, it's for 7 years, like I didn't have this opportunity.
Finally, Shazat got her visa and joined Rami in the U.S. earlier this year. And just 2 months later, their son, Kosai, was born.
I think God helped me. I think everything came together.
Today, Rami is an attending at Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn. Of late, he's been treating patients with COVID-19. His caseload quadrupled. Equipment was in short supply. All that improvising back in Syria has proven useful.
We don't have gowns. We don't have masks. It wasn't like that big deal for me. Okay, give me whatever is available and I will wear it and go. I said, yes, we will help people because we are all together fighting this virus, this enemy. When they need us, we were here to help.
And once again, it's Ramadan. Rami's long hours at the hospital are again pushing his break fast a little later into the night, just like back in Jordan with all those babies born right about sundown. But now, when Rami comes home after a long day of treating patients with COVID-19 and other ailments, he's got his family to celebrate with. They share bowls of soup and plates of salad and chicken at a table in their Brooklyn kitchen. It's four-month-old Kosai's first Ramadan, obviously, but it's also Rami and Shaza's first Ramadan together, ever.
It's a great. It's the first time we are in this together, so I'm so excited.
Like, I feel like I'm a normal person now. It's a huge change in my life.
At last, the long fast is over. For the world, I'm Ari Daniel.
Nursing homes have been hit hard by the coronavirus. That means many care facilities worldwide are not allowing in-person visits, i.e. no families or loved ones. That's only aggravating a problem that many older adults faced before this pandemic, loneliness. A nursing home in Wassenaar in the Netherlands has come up with a solution. They've built a visitor cabin in their back garden. Friends and family can come visit safely while separated by panes of glass. Willem Holleman is the director of Claris Zorgroep Nursing Homes. So, Willem, describe this glass garden house to us. What's it like inside?
It's built like one room, only divided by a glass window. It has two entrances. People who come in, visitors or our residents, walk into a nice, cozy, warm room with a couch, a coffee machine, a few lamps, a few paintings on the wall, just like their apartments in our care home.
How does it work, though? Families have to schedule a time to meet their loved ones at the home, and then how long can they stay during a visit?
Yes, we have four visiting times a day. They last three quarters of an hour, and there's, each time there's a space of an hour in between, because we have to make sure it's all COVID-19 proof. Mm. So we use alcoholic towels. There can only be two family members of one household at a time. They have to wear gloves. And it's professionally cleaned twice a day. And so we have four visiting times a day.
What have you heard from residents at the home about what a difference this has made for them?
Yeah, it's made a huge difference for our residents. They felt lonely. They felt isolated. We used Zooming or WhatsApp or things like that. But our residents are unable to understand it's real time or live. They're seeing on the iPad. They need to see each other. They need to make eye contact. They need to laugh or cry together. And in our glass cabin, it's possible to reunite families after, well, a few weeks of isolation in the lockdown. And it's great to watch family members meet each other again. The first visit was on a Saturday when we first opened our glass cabin. Two daughters came for the first time in 3.5 weeks and saw their mother again for the first time. Wow. They all cried for about a few minutes, right, 5 minutes. Then they start laughing and then they start talking for 3/4 of an hour. I really recommend this for all care homes or nursing homes all around.
I understand the Netherlands has started taking slow steps toward easing restrictions for coronavirus. What does that mean for your care home, and how concerned are you about the threat of COVID spreading in the home moving forward?
We've taken great measures not letting COVID in our care homes. We had a shutdown of our care homes a week before our government said we should. It's been possible for us to keep COVID-19 out of our care homes until now, at least, making it possible to visit again. I think we have to be very careful and thoughtful how we should do it and how we can let visits take place again in our care homes. Better a few weeks later and good and safe than too early and get COVID in your care homes.
Willem Holleman is director of the Claris Nursing Home in Wassenaar in the Netherlands, where they've installed a safe cabin with glass dividers for families to visit with their loved ones at the home. Willem, what a great idea. Thanks very much for telling us about it.
Thanks for having me.
The coronavirus hit Madrid hard, and its strict lockdown means parks are still closed. But in a city where many live in small apartments, people are pushing to get back to their green spaces. Jennifer Omane reports.
On a warm spring evening, madrileños are taking their daily exercise, which is only permitted for a few hours in the morning and a couple more in the evening due to the coronavirus pandemic. They're walking around the perimeter of one of the city's largest parks, El Retiro, because its gates remain firmly shut. The sidewalk is narrow and everyone is vying for space while trying to keep a mandatory 6 feet distance from each other. Alia Ponth is already thinking of heading home.
I haven't been out much, to be honest with you. There have been days when I've felt a bit overwhelmed by this. But every 2 or 3 days, I do try to get out of the house.
Although the city closes some roads to traffic at the weekend, keeping a safe distance to avoid contamination is impossible with the volume of people on the streets. Alia originally supported the city's closed parks policy, but she's changed her mind.
At the beginning of the pandemic, it seemed like a reasonable measure to prevent people gathering in the parks. But after the first few days, when we were allowed out to walk again, people had to stick to the edges of the park.
Alia is not alone in her frustration. Madrid is the only major city in Spain that has yet to reopen its parks. More and more people are wondering why. Madrid's mayor, José Luis Martínez Almeida, says it's because too many people rushed to green spaces at the beginning of the pandemic.
If we open the parks and green spaces, it's possible that large groups of people will gather. We have to remember the incidents that forced us to close the parks in the first place, before the state of emergency was even declared.
Enter José Luis Mazón Costa, a lawyer who calls himself a Don Quixote for the 21st century. Like the protagonist of Miguel de Cervantes' classic novel, he's undertaking noble deeds to save Spain from itself. Right now, he's suing the mayor of Madrid to take back the city's parks.
When I want to use my exercise time, the 6 hours a day the government gives me to leave my prison, that's my house, I find that the mayor of Madrid has closed all the parks? Well, that seems absurd to me.
Spain is a sparsely populated country, but its cities are some of the most densely populated in Europe.
Here, we don't have gardens. Those who live in Madrid maybe have some flower pots you can hang on the balcony. That's about it. The parks are where you go to breathe again and are a way of taking walks that are relaxing.
José Luis deliberately tried to enter a closed park in the west of the city in early May and was quickly stopped by the police.
The local police told me to get out, and I told them, no way.
He returned home with a fine of 1,500 euros and the fury of a wronged man. The lawyer has actually filed 2 legal complaints, one criminal and 1 civil. He accuses the mayor of exercising powers that belong to the national government and impeding the freedom of movement of its citizens as a result. The court will hear his case this Saturday, and he's optimistic about his chances.
I enjoy taking on the Giants. And let me tell you something. I think 2020 is the year everything changes. It's a year of great possibilities, a year when lost causes will win out.
José Luis can already claim a small victory. Right after his first legal complaint was filed, the city agreed to reopen some of its much smaller green spaces, while insisting the large parks had to stay shut. Whether this Don Quixote of the parks will succeed in his quest is up to the judge. For The World, Jennifer Omani in Madrid.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston and online at theworld.org. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.